Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox here on the internet at cindysheehansoapbox.com. I have a new mission in life, and that is to stop military recruitment. I believe that the robber class wars will go on, the robber class rape and pillage of other countries, of our children in the robbed class, will continue. We have seen it continue with a Democratic Congress and a Democratic president. We see no end in sight to the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. So my new mission is to prevent our young people from going into the military. We can't stop the robber class wars, no matter how much we march, no matter how many petitions we sign or whatever. So we have to, here on our level, prevent our children from becoming cannon fodder or paid assassins for the war machine, or for the robber class war machine. My guest today, we will be talking about female abuse and harassment in the military, and I have Ann Wright, who is a good friend of mine, a colonel in the military, and Sarah Rich will be having a panel. Sarah's daughter, Suzanne Swift, was sexually harassed in the military, and Sarah and Suzanne have set out on a campaign to enlighten and educate people. So this is Cindy Sheehan. This is Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. When we come back, we'll be talking to Ann and Sarah. Stay tuned.
First, they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. If you would like to keep your voice on the air, and you feel this show is important, please contribute now. Go to www.cindysheehanssoapbox.com. That's CindySheehanssoapbox.com. The phone is 562-912-5860. That number again is 562-912-5860. Please help us keep this show on the air. Your generous contribution is appreciated.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox here on the internet at cindysheehansoapbox.com. And while you're on my website, check out the other features like my blogs and my book, Myth America. Look around the site and become familiar with it. And you can always contact me at cindy@cindysheehansoapbox.com. As I promised before the break, we have two wonderful sheroes of mine, Sarah Rich and Ann Wright. Sarah became active in the anti-war movement when her daughter, Suzanne Swift, was sexually harassed and had all kinds of problems happen because of that. And my other dear friend, Ann Wright, it was a colonel in the U.S. military. She was a diplomat who has extensive foreign policy experience, but also has experience working with female veterans. Sarah, welcome to my show.
Hi, Cindy.
And Ann, welcome to my show.
Oh, great to be with you, Cindy. Thank you.
And we're all three friends, so we have had a lot of conversations around all these issues. And we could actually have shows with all my guests on other issues, too. Last week, we spoke to Ray McGovern about Afghanistan. And, Ann, I know you're particularly up to speed on that issue.
Well, indeed, I have a personal connection with it in that back in December of 2001, I was one of the small team of diplomats who went to Afghanistan to reopen the U.S. embassy there, and was very concerned about the Bush administration's policies there, and with the Obama administration increasing the numbers of people going in there now after, 7 years,
right.
It's quite a mess.
And you were concerned with, in your career, being in the military and being in the diplomatic Corps, you were concerned with U.S. foreign policy a lot, but there was one thing that finally pushed you over the edge, wasn't there?
Well, indeed. It was the decision of the Bush administration to invade and occupy an oil-rich Arab Muslim country that had not attacked the United States and had nothing to do with 9/11, and that was the decision to invade and occupy Iraq. And I ended up resigning in March of 2003 in opposition to that war. And ever since then, I've been working with people like yourself and Sarah Rich on stopping wars and proper treatment of our veterans when they return.
And Anne actually is one of the hardest working people in the peace movement. She helped me at Camp Casey every single time we went to Crawford. She helped coordinate the volunteers and coordinate activities. And she just is very admirable. And you actually live the same place, your home base, you don't get to visit there very often, is the same place where Barack Obama vacations, right?
That's right, in Hawaii. And in fact, in December, during the Christmas vacation this last year, I happened to get to go back to Hawaii for a couple of days. And we were out in front of his compound with signs, even before he became president, on the issue of Gaza, on his need to speak out about the incredibly horrible attack of the Israeli Defense Forces on Gaza. Not to condone at all the unguided rockets that Hamas and other militant groups had sent into Israel, but the 1,400 people killed by the Israelis was just, I mean, it's a war crime what happened. And so we were there to say, you have to speak out.
Well, it would be actually also a much nicer place to protest than Crawford, Texas, in the middle of August, right?
as a matter of fact, one of the ABC TV men that was out covering Obama in Hawaii, he had been in Crawford one time, and he recognized me and he said, I can't believe that you finally figured out that if you're going to protest, you ought to go to someplace like Hawaii.
Well, I used to joke also that I hope the next president, you know, would have a more logical place to vacation than Crawford, Texas. So,
Anne,
I'm going to be going to Gaza at the end of May, I think. So I want to have you back on the show and we'll talk about that issue because that's a very important issue. I had Cynthia McKinney on a couple of weeks ago talking about it also. But let's get back to Sarah. Sarah, can you tell us in a short amount of time what happened to Suzanne and your daughter Suzanne and what spurred you to working in this movement?
Well, I've always been a human rights activist, even before she joined the military. And when she joined the military, she was told by the recruiter that she, if she signed up for 5 years, she wouldn't be deployed to a combat zone.
Right.
Immediately, she was sent to a combat zone. Neither of us had any idea about military sexual assault or about that there was a term called military sexual trauma, MST, or anything about command rape. Suzanne was more than just harassed. She was actually raped by a commanding officer in Iraq, and we didn't quite understand what was going on, but it was she was harassed by one of her commanding officers, raped by another, and then harassed by another. So it was three different men, all who had direct authority over her in a combat zone, because she did see combat. It wasn't that she was stationed somewhere safe. She was shot at. She was a combat she was doing combat patrol. She was the driver of a Humvee doing combat patrol in Karbala in 04-05. And the whole time she was there, I kept thinking, this isn't right. This is wrong. What can I do? And then finally when she got out of Iraq, I said, now can we say something? Can we do something? Because she was too scared for me to say something while she was in Iraq because, you know, we have cases like Lavina Johnson where, women speak out and they are murdered.
Right.
So she was too scared to say anything. And finally, she was being redeployed to Iraq for a second time. And her PTSD and military sexual trauma just exploded and she went AWOL instead of returning, which was a huge turning point in a whole family. She refused to go back. She went AWOL. We got an attorney and a psychologist, and that's when we finally started coming out about the sexual assault and the rape and all of the trauma that she experienced while in Iraq. Because up until that point, it just was too raw for her to talk about. So she was seeing a psychologist. We had an attorney. We were trying to work with the Army to get her, you know, so she could turn herself in and get the help she needed, but nobody would work with us. So finally, the AWOL apprehension team called their good buddies down here in Eugene at Eugene Police Department, and they sent people to our home at 10:30 on a Sunday night and took her in handcuffs. You know, here we have this, you know, by then she's, how old was she, about 22 by then? 22-year-old who'd been raped, who had been, had, you know, combat trauma, and they put her in handcuffs and threw her in jail.
She had been raped. She had been the victim of a crime. Actually, while she was stationed in another profound crime, a crime against humanity and international crime, the occupation of Iraq, were her assaulters, were her rapists and her harassers, were they hauled off in handcuffs anytime?
No.
So it's just like we have two sets of laws, I think, in our country. You know, I was talking to somebody last night, and I was on a radio show here in San Francisco, Carell's show, and he was talking to me about how many times I've been hauled out of Congress in handcuffs, and, you know, Anne has too, and we've spent many hours in D.C. Jails together, but... Then we talked about Karl Rove. Karl Rove has ignored subpoenas from Congress, and he's not hauled off in handcuffs. So what?
Right.
So what was the, you know, the outcome of Suzanne's case?
Well, they did a preliminary investigation, and then the general sent it back and said, "Do another one because that's not, you know," they concluded an initial investigation in 3 days. You know, the guy said, "We didn't do it. She was a slut." And they said, "Okay, case closed." And then somebody said, "No, you need to do a more extensive investigation." They ended up court-martialing Suzanne and sending her to prison for 30 days and stripped her of all her rank. And, you know, Suzanne, you know, we went into this, you know, we spent $15,000 on attorneys, and nobody was in that court-martial but me and Suzanne. When it came down to it, it was just us against the U.S. military.
Uh-huh.
And they stripped her of her rank and sent her to prison.
And ultimately, nothing has happened to the people who raped her.
No. The man who raped her, his wife ended up calling us about a year ago saying she was divorcing him. I always call them the molester because his name is Mark Lester.
Uh-huh.
And... she told me that he had been hired as a police officer in Kent, Washington. And so I put a blast out to my friends saying, you know, call the mayor, call the police chief. And by the end of the week, he was fired.
Well, at least he had a little bit of accountability. But, you know, there was Mark Lester that raped Suzanne, but actually the entire system raped Suzanne.
You better believe it.
You know, and this is a absolute tragedy. I have read statistics where at least 30% of females are sexually harassed or raped in the military. And, of course, that's probably a much higher number. And we read and are still hearing about cases where female soldiers have died of dehydration in Iraq because they don't drink water because they don't want to get up to use the latrine in the middle of the night because they don't want to be raped. So here Suzanne was in a war zone battling, you know, the resistance, the Iraqi resistance, but she also had to battle her fellow soldiers, her colleagues. You know, to me, if this isn't a reason to not join the military, I don't know what could be a reason. So thank you, Sarah. We'll come back to you in a second. And
okay.
Sarah talked about the case of Lavina Johnson, and I know you have worked with the family and you know about the case. Can you tell my listeners about the case of Lavina Johnson?
Sure, I will tell them about it. Let me just mention, though, that on the statistics on sexual harassment, well over 90% of the women who are in the military say that they have been sexually harassed. Sexual assault and rape, the crimes of sexual assault and rape, that's where 1 in 3 soldiers, service members, are saying that they have been sexually assaulted or raped while they've been in the military. And these are figures, statistics that are given by the Veterans Administration.
So, but sexual harassment is almost 100%.
That's right. That's right. Yes, it is. The case of Lavina Johnson, a young woman, 21 years old, who had gone to, or 19 years old, pardon me, 19 years old, who had gone to Iraq, within 2 weeks after her having been there, she ended up being found in a tent, a burning tent. She had been shot in the head, and when her parents were notified of her death, they were told she was dead of a non-combat related incident. And out of the, I believe it's 105 women now, military women, have been found in Iraq dead of non-combat related incidents. And of those, 104 have been killed in Iraq, and 43 have been killed in what they call non-combat related incidents. And of that 43, there are 15 of them that when you look at the cases, you think, there's something really strange. And one of them is Lavina Johnson, who was found shot in a tent. When her body came back to her home in Missouri, and they had the body at the funeral home, her mom and dad, you know, touched their daughter's body. The mother tried to rub her hand, and the gloves the military had put on, her hand would not move. And they looked at the gloves, and they had been glued on. And so they went to the mortuary guy and said, "What's going on here? We want to see why these things were glued on." And when they cut those off, they saw that her hand had been burned, and indeed, her whole body, the one side of her body, had been burned. So how was this non-combat related incident? Why was she burned? Well, over a period of 2.5 years, as the family kept begging the military for information, first to get the autopsy, then later on to try to find the documents about the death, try to get information that is held by the military, but they won't give it to the families unless you file a Freedom of Information Act on it. Well, ultimately, after 2.5 years, they finally got the CD that contained the photographs of her body as her body was undressed in Iraq before it was shipped back to the United States. And the body showed that she had been beaten in the face, that her nose had been broken, that there were, the father says that it appears that there were bite marks on her body, that one of her arms had been distended and kind of dislocated, that there were, that her vaginal area looked as though she had been sexually assaulted, and then a caustic acid poured in her genital area. So the Johnson family has been demanding that the military review this case, that they do not believe that, the military has said that she committed suicide, that no one killed her, that she committed suicide with all of those injuries.
Wow.
She committed suicide. So I've been assisting the family to try to get a hearing before the Army, to make the Army reopen that case. And we've gone to Congress to try to get congressmen and women involved in this. And it's a real slow process of making the Army reopen cases. You know, the Pat Tillman case, here after 3 congressional hearings on his death in Afghanistan, we now know that he was shot by friendly fire. He was shot in the head. It looks like he was assassinated. And yet, after 3 congressional hearings, the parents of Pat Tillman don't know who among that small unit that Pat Tillman was a part of, who killed Pat Tillman and why. So for a family like Lavina Johnson, who has no political pull, their daughter was not an NFL star. She was just one of hundreds of thousands of young men and women who decide to join the military and then terrible things happen to them. The family is still pushing very, very hard on the military to try to get more answers to what happened to their daughter. But one thing for sure, they do not believe she committed suicide, nor do I.
Well, and then I have also friends whose children, they were told that their children committed suicide. Our friend Juan What's Juan's?
Torres.
Pardon me?
Juan Torres.
Yeah, Juan Torres was told his son John committed suicide. And then when they finally got the autopsy report, there was no way. And John was about to expose, he was actually killed in Afghanistan, and he was about to expose drug trade on his base. And so he was assassinated, and they know who did it, and he still hasn't been held accountable. But you know, Robert J. Lipton, who's a sociologist, said that war is an atrocity-producing event, and it will always produce atrocities. And it will take our young people who normally would not, you know, even think of rape or raping their own fellow soldiers, raping young women in Iraq or in the battlefield. And they do things that, you know, to us seem animalistic. And that's another good reason to not allow your child to join the military. But Anne, getting off of the sexual assault and rape thing for a minute, back in 2004, right after my son was killed, the whole scandal of Abu Ghraib came out. And the only people who have been held accountable who have had to pay any price for that, of course, were you know, like a corporal or, you know, somebody very low rank. But also General Janice Karpinski was, she had, I think she was, had her rank taken away from her.
She was demoted.
She was demoted. So again, even though we both feel that she did, she didn't fulfill her duty, why wasn't someone like Sanchez held accountable for that?
Well, generals are very seldom held accountable, and for General Karpinski to have been demoted was really quite a it is the oddity in all of the Iraq War that it just happened to be a woman general that was demoted. She says now that, you know, she was, we've all talked at length with her. She said she was in charge of 17 prisons, that she, of course, she is horrified about what happened in that Abu Ghraib prison. And she says, yes, we should have been watching much more carefully what was going on in that prison. She said that the intelligence officers, that a wing of that prison had been designated by Sanchez to be run by the intelligence people. And it was the intelligence guys that were giving the orders to her military police to soften up those prisoners so they could get more intelligence out of them. And, I mean, all of the officers should have been watching. And I would say to General Karpinski, and not that I need to say anything to her, she certainly acknowledges that they needed to be watching very much more. But at the very senior levels where the decisions were made, that those intelligence officers were going to soften up those detainees, and that the only ones that have been held responsible are, you know, a couple of sergeants and then specialists and privates. It's pretty astounding that the people who instituted the policies of torture, starting with President Bush, Vice President Cheney, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, chief of the Justice Department, all of those, you know, nothing's happened to them. Although there's certainly a lot of people out there that are working hard to see that indictments are placed against all of them.
Well,
and
let's talk
many
about
people
that.
Ready for citizens' arrest.
Yeah, let's talk about that when we come back. We have to take a short break. You're listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. We're having a fascinating conversation with Sarah Rich, Supermom, and former Colonel Anne Wright. We'll be right back after this short break.
So this was death. So this was a dead body. Simple. Here was a man who was no longer alive. Here was a soldier whose family did not yet know how he would be coming home. Here was a person who had had a life, a story, thoughts, and a consciousness like mine. Here was what everyone I knew, mother, father, sisters, would one day become. Here is how I would end up one day. A body. Gone. Simple. One Marine was in charge of taking notes and filling out paperwork while another cut off boots, socks, trousers, and shirt to find wounds or tattoos or old scars. It took two of us to take fingerprints. We would dip each finger into ink, press them onto little boxes on a paper form. We went through pockets, emptying and inventorying the contents. We looked at dog tags. The Mortuary Affairs Unit got tentative ID on all U.S. casualties and prepared the remains for shipment to Kuwait and then to Dover Air Force Base, where DNA samples would be used to positively identify them. This soldier was not in too bad a state. He had died a few hours before from gunshot wounds, and rigor mortis had already set in. His body was dirty, stiff, and pale, but intact. His mouth was set in a grimace which made him difficult to look at for too long. The smell was wet and sweet and thick.
Coming In Hot is a new solo performance work featuring Jean Marie Simpson, adapted from the book Powder, Writing by Women in the Ranks from Vietnam to Iraq. For more information, including booking inquiries, please visit JeanMarieSimpson.com.
First, they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. If you would like to keep your voice on the air and you feel this show is important, please contribute now. Go to www.CindySheehansSoapbox.com. That's CindySheehansSoapbox.com. The phone is 562-912-5860. That number again is 562-912-5860. Please help us keep this show on the air. Your generous contribution is appreciated.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Here at CindySheehansSoapbox.com, we're speaking to Sarah Rich and Anne Wright about harassment of females in the military. And we were talking about Abu Ghraib and Janice Karpinski. And when we said Sanchez, we need to fill in my audience. It was General Rick Sanchez, right, who was actually Karpinski's superior.
That's correct. He was the head of U.S. forces in Iraq in the early 2003, and she worked directly for him.
And do you think that Karpinski was demoted because she was a woman and she was the scapegoat?
Oh, absolutely. I think so. That there's no doubt that because she was a woman, they decided that was an easy place to pin the blame on that explosive story that was coming out about all the prisoners. Certainly Donald Rumsfeld wasn't going to say, oh, yeah, that was our policy. Sorry about that. They needed a fall person, and it was a woman. But she didn't fall easily.
Or quietly.
She was on TV, or quietly. She immediately went on a campaign on TV where she really got out there in front of the story. I've never seen anything quite like it. I remember seeing her the first time on TV thinking, holy smoke, she's out there talking about all of this before any of the administrative procedures have gone on. And she knew what she was doing. She needed to get out in front of it, although it did not save her from a demotion in rank, an administrative demotion, not a court-martial.
Right. Well, good for her, and thank you for that. And so, Sarah, let's get back to you. And on the break, you were telling me about some synchronicities between Suzanne, your daughter, and Lavina Johnson, and what happened to you and her parents in Congress.
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I found out about Lavina's case, it just sent absolute shivers up my spine, thinking this is what would have happened to my daughter if she had told about what was going on to her to her superior officers in Iraq.
Right.
This is what would have happened. She would have been murdered. They would have said it was a suicide. You know, and their birthdays are very close to each other. They're a few years apart, but their birthdays are within a couple days of each other. And it just made me feel so thankful that my daughter was, you know, still with us.
Right.
Where Lavina is not. And it made me feel, you know, the Johnsons and I have a real heart connection.
Mm-hmm.
I feel very protective about Suzanne, and I think about Lavina every day. It's just we have a very, very deep connection about that. And when Ann and the Johnsons and I were going to congressmen and congresswomen and senators, trying to talk to them about reopening Lavina's case and showing them that it was not a suicide, it was in a murder, they were treated in a way that just infuriated me. I mean, here they have, you know, a fallen soldier who was, you know, obviously raped and murdered, and they were sent, they were being taken to these little teeny rooms with junior staffers and weren't being given the respect and care that, that we are, we as military parents of combat veterans should be, you know, absolutely demanding from people that, you know, say that they run our country.
Oh, absolutely. And I was talking earlier with Ann, and, you know, Ann and I have been arrested several times together, but you and I have been arrested together too, right?
We sure have.
It's the Cindy Sheehan Soapbox, and 60 to 70% of my guests are people who I've been arrested with. So, you know, it's just something that I think that we have to do. And for the Johnsons to be treated with such disrespect, and, you know, I've been treated with a lot of disrespect there on Capitol Hill. And not only should we be treated with respect because our children have given ultimate sacrifices, have had their lives stolen from them, or even, you know, Suzanne, you know, struggling with PTSD and the issues that everything that's happened to her. I'm very proud of her, what she's been able to accomplish and to overcome. But it's dicey every day, isn't it, Sarah?
It absolutely is. You know, the IRR, the, you know, inactive ready reserves, two sergeants came to our house yesterday. And, you know, because we've had such hard times with the military and with the police, anybody that's in uniform that shows up to our house in a government car, we all kind of go into a frozen panic.
Right.
So they come to my house looking for Suzanne, and Suzanne doesn't live with us. But, you know, we're like, well, we haven't seen her. Because we're not, you know, I don't want her to be exposed to any more of this government slavery, which is, you know, what happens when you sign on the dotted line. You know, you're basically, your life is not your own anymore. And I don't think people are making informed choices when they're signing their lives on the dotted line when they enlist.
Oh, absolutely. And my son, Casey, did not. And I think that's one of the reasons that we in the peace movement have to do counter recruitment. And that has to be one of our main focuses. And I'm going to come back to you. My first question to you, I thought that the Pentagon under the Defense Secretary, Robert Gates, who's Obama's Defense Secretary and was also George Bush's last Defense Secretary after Rumsfeld resigned, did away with the IRR, or was that just the IRR for people who were in the National Guard?
Well, no, I think that the IRR still stands for the Army Reserve for sure.
Mm-hmm.
What they have done away with was stop loss.
Oh, that's right.
After a certain point, I think after this summer, then there are no more stop losses in the system. But I wanted to say that here it is, this weekend is the commemoration of Casey's passing, and
right.
Our heart goes out to you and your family on, you know, that very difficult day for remembering Casey.
You know, 5 years, it's just amazing. It seems like 5 minutes sometimes, but, you know, as you both know, I have a new grandson, Jonah, and he's 10.5 months old, and I have another grandchild on the way, and Sarah and I were talking about how just amazingly wonderful it is to be a grandparent. Even like, it's like a infinity times more than being a parent. And Jonah has given my family back joy and that we never thought we would have again. So it's just very, he's just a little heart mender. But that's why I dedicate my life every day to this cause, because I don't want Jonah or Sarah's grandson Lucky to go through the same thing that Casey and Suzanne and Lavina and just tens of thousands of other of our soldiers, just because of Iraq and Afghanistan. We don't have time to talk about Vietnam and, you know, our friends and soldiers or vets that are struggling from that war. But my Producer Scott brought up a good point when we were on the break. Not only are females in the military sexually harassed, raped, other kinds of violence on them, but soldiers have a higher percentage of also domestic violence, right? And abusing their wives and their children. And what part do you think that, like, alcohol abuse and PTSD plays in this?
Well, both PTSD and alcohol abuse play a tremendous role in domestic violence within military families. For men and women coming back from the combat zone, where they are having a very difficult time coping with the day-to-day things that a family does that they used to be able to handle just fine, but now they come back and the slightest noise startles them, and people, little kids, you know, playing and yelling at each other, that startles them, and having to deal with things like paying bills that they didn't really have to do because they were in the battle zone. They didn't have to worry about that sort of stuff. All of these day-to-day things really weigh heavy, and sometimes the lashing out of in domestic violence or in murders. I mean, there have been a rash of murders that have happened. There were four last year in North Carolina alone,
right,
where the spouses or significant others of four military men, all four of these women were in the military themselves,
right,
and they were murdered just in that state. And then in around Fort Carson, Colorado, in the last 2 years, there have been 9 women murdered by military guys. So there's a lot of, I mean, when you teach people to be violent on and try to control it just in one place on a battlefield with no lines, that when you bring them back home, sometimes the battlefield comes with them, and the acting out and the same sorts of techniques are used on their family members and friends.
Well, and as I often say, my son came home in a, you know, in a coffin. But none of the soldiers come home the same person. So they all go over there one person, and they come home a different person. And that's really the tragedy of war. And another tragedy, which is an obscenity, is oftentimes these soldiers can't get the help that they need from the VA system or from the military you know, healthcare system. Our friends, the Lucys, their son Jeffrey was found hanging in their basement from PTSD, and he couldn't get the help he needs. And his PTSD was misdiagnosed, I think, probably purposefully, so he wouldn't be counted as a PTSD statistic. So it's just very tragic that, you know, the robber class, they start these wars for profit, and then we in the rob class are the ones that lose our children or have to go through these horrible, you know, episodes without any help, or in fact, not only without help, but with actually additional stresses put on us. And I know that you're also involved in veterans retreats, but you're a veteran also, and you're involved in these retreats with female veterans, aren't you?
Yes, I've been to several of them. I unfortunately won't be able to be in Oregon for the one next week. I know it's going to be a very, very important one, and I wish everyone the very best.
What happens in those that you can talk about that wouldn't
Surely.
Violate any kind of, you know, confidentiality or without naming names?
Mm-hmm. Well, when women who've been in the military come together, of course, it's within a group that you feel much more comfortable talking about what has happened to you while you've been in the military. There is a bond between those who have been in the military, and it's kind of a weird one, but people do open up to each other much more readily when you're around other people with shared experiences. And sometimes for women who have had some very difficult times in the military, coming to those retreats, they're able to open up a little bit and to talk with others and find out that they are not alone, that they aren't the only ones that these things have happened to. And I was at a retreat about 2 years ago where we had about 30 women, and I'll tell you what, by the end of the evening, it was unbelievable. All of the things that people were talking about that happened to them, I almost was stunned by how much these women had been through. So I really, I think these veterans programs are so important, so very important to having a, you know, the healing process start for the women. So I wish everyone in Portland a very good weekend.
And Ann, you, as you've told me, it's not just, you know, privates or, you know, non-com officers. I mean, it's actually been people who have been career military that attend these retreats, right?
Yes, sometimes. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, there's a wide variety of people that are helping with the retreat. Some are hosted by counseling groups, and of course there are always trained counselors that are there to help women through, you know, the really rough aspects of this. So they're very, very useful and helpful. The Veterans Administration actually sponsors some of them, and there are pardon me, I believe there are four residential programs now that the Veterans Administration has on the issue of sexual assault. And from what I've heard from many of the women, that those are excellent programs. And we're, unfortunately, they probably need about five times as many residential programs.
Well, let's get back to Sarah, because Sarah is involved in the one in Portland, Oregon. And I really want to, my listeners who know someone, a female who's been in the military, who's been sexually harassed or any other kind of harassment, or are a female who has gone through that, because I do have listeners I know that have had this happen to them, how they can get and avail themselves of these services or get in touch with either one of you ladies, because I know you'd be happy to help these people out, or at least to be able to help them find the resources they need. So, Sarah, can you tell us about the retreat in Oregon this weekend?
Sure. It's actually going to be next weekend.
Oh,
Easter
next weekend. Uh-huh.
And it's down in the Applegate Valley, which is down in southern Oregon. There's this is a pilot program. We're really trying to find a way that we can take this on the road and start providing healing retreats in every state, because the need is so great in women veterans, the need to connect, the need to heal. And I'm one of three trauma-informed therapists that's going to be helping facilitate this weekend. And we're going to come together and really take care of each other and take care of our veterans, because that's what needs to happen. We're trying to offer it as low cost as possible so that it's available and accessible for everybody, and just create a place that's safe for women to connect with each other and connect with themselves.
Is there a website or an email that my listeners could access?
Well, if they want to get a hold of me, they can go to, you know, SuzanneSwift.org. And you can email me through that website.
And is there a website for the retreats yet?
No. We haven't gotten that far. We're actually going to be doing we're going to be doing research and trying to find ways to really make this a pilot program, so that we can replicate it and get some real funding, grant funding, so that we can make these accessible to everybody.
And people can get through you, through to you through SuzanneSwift.org. That's SuzanneSwift.org.
Correct.
And Anne, how can my listeners get a hold of you?
Okay, through my book website, which is VoicesOfConscience.com. All one word, VoicesOfConscience.com.
And what are you doing in Memphis right now?
Well, I'm actually in Nashville.
Oh, Nashville,
and,
sorry.
tonight I'm speaking at the Nashville Peace and Justice Center, and then tomorrow I'm speaking, interestingly enough, at the annual meeting of the Society of Women, or the Society of Military Historians. And I'm going to be on a panel that talk about the effects of war on women.
Oh, wow. That sounds super interesting. So tell us your website one more time, Anne.
Okay. It's voicesofconscience.com.
And I really believe that, you know, we as women have the skill to talk about our problems, and we don't. I don't want to like seem, you know, chauvinistic or anything, but I think men have more of a problem of internalizing things and trying to bury things instead of talking about them, and instead of, you know, bringing them out in the open. And like Anne, like you said, talking to people who have had the same things happen to them is part of healing. And you're not going to be able to heal unless you can talk it out and find somebody who can talk it out with you. And I know I've talked to many Gold Star mothers like myself, and many times when I'm with those other Gold Star mothers is the only time I feel really whole, because like you said, they know exactly what I'm going through. So Anne, thank you for being on my show, and I want to have you on again soon to talk about Gaza.
Thank you. It's been my Cindy. Thanks so much.
Well, hopefully we'll run into each other over there in Hawaii. We'll have Camp KC Oahu. How's that sound?
I think that's a great place for it.
And Sarah, thank you so much for being on, and love to you and your family and your struggle. And thank you both for taking your lives and making them try to help people and make the world a better place.
Thank you. Love you.
Thank you, honey.
Okay. Love you guys. You're listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. We'll be right back with my soapbox rant. Are you effing kidding me?
First, they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. If you would like to keep your voice on the air and you feel this show is important, please contribute now. Go to www.cindysheehanssoapbox.com. That's CindySheehanssoapbox.com. The phone is 562-912-5860. That number again is 562-912-5860. Please help us keep this show on the air. Your generous contribution is appreciated.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox here at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Yesterday was the 5th anniversary of my son's death in Iraq and the 41st anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. Casey was killed because of his country's callous, careless, and compassionless foreign policy. And Dr. King was killed because he had started to speak out against the policy 41 years ago. Today, we are in a more devastating spot than we were 41 years ago. Our country is overtly imperialistic, and our, quote, change you can believe in, end quote, president has demonstrated several times in his short administration that he's just a servant of empire and we are still its slaves. We called for a demo to protest Obama's escalation in Afghanistan here in San Francisco last week. I was attacked by so-called progressives who would have opposed such actions during the Bush regime, but who support the actions because Obama is doing it. One man even told me that I should be ashamed of myself because I was just like Rush Limbaugh because I want Obama to fail. Are you effing kidding me? I'm nothing like Limbaugh in the first place. But in the second place, I told this person, you're damn right I want Obama to fail in killing more people for profit. And if you don't, then shame on you. And shame on anyone who supports Obama's foreign policies. And shame on the anti-Republican war movement in this country. United for Peace and Justice, a national coalition that was co-opted by the Democratic Party along with MoveOn.org, held a protest on Wall Street yesterday. A Saturday. Are you effing kidding me? Who in the robber class is going to give an F that anyone is marching to nowhere on a Saturday on Wall Street? Besides annoying some tourists, I'm wondering what UFPJ hoped to accomplish. Feeling good? Patting ourselves on the back that we walked from point A to point B, chanted some meaningless chants, and then went home? That's not going to affect the systemic changes we so desperately need. In not wanting to embarrass the Democrats, UFPJ and GS answers Saturday march on the closed Pentagon and closed government offices embarrass the movement. The only things that'll change the robber class will be mass civil disobedience on days that the robber class systems are functioning, and they usually function against us. It would take 500 people rotating on a daily basis to shut down Capitol Hill and or Wall Street. We don't need tens of thousands of people. We don't need hundreds of thousands of people. We just need hundreds of people to shut down Capitol Hill and Wall Street. And then you get arrested, and then you go back and do it again. And you have people rotating to do this. Preventing business as usual is our only hope. Now we're going to listen to a speech by Major General Smedley Butler called War is a Racket. Major General Butler was a highly decorated Marine Corps general that wrote this between World War I and World War II. It should be the standard reading in every junior high and high school and college in this country. It should be discussed. It should be shouted from the rooftops. It should be on CNN. It should be on MSNBC. It should be on Fox. It should be on Clear Channel. But you have it here on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Today, Major General Smedley Butler had these words to say at the National VFW.
War is a racket. It always has been. It is possibly the oldest, easily the most profitable, surely the most vicious. It is international in scope. It is the only one in which the profits are reckoned in dollars and the losses in lives. There are only two things we should fight for. One is the defense of our homes, and the other is the Bill of Rights. War, for any other reason, is simply a racket. It may seem odd for me, a military man, to adopt such a comparison. Truthfulness compels me to. I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service as a member of this country's most agile military force, the Marine Corps. I served in all commissioned ranks from second lieutenant to major general. And during that period, I spent most of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and for the bankers. I suspected I was just part of a racket at the time. Now I am sure of it. I helped make Mexico safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National Citibank boys. I helped in the raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefits of Wall Street. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers in 1910. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for American sugar interests in 1916. In China, I helped to see to it that Standard Oil went its way unmolested. Looking back on it, I feel I could have given Al Capone a few tips. The best he could do was operate his racket in three districts. I operated on three continents. A racket is best described, I believe, as something that is not what it seems to the majority of the people. Only a small, inside group knows what it is about. It is conducted for the benefit of the very few at the expense of the very many. In the World War, a mere handful garnered the profits of the conflict. At least 21,000 new millionaires and billionaires were made in the United States during the World War. How many of these war millionaires shouldered a rifle? How many of them dug a trench? How many of them knew what it meant to go hungry in a rat-infested dugout? How many of them spent sleepless, frightened nights ducking shells and shrapnel and machine gun bullets? Out of war, nations acquire additional territory if they are victorious. They just take it. This newly acquired territory promptly is exploited by the few, the selfsame few who wrung dollars out of blood in the war. The general public shoulders the bill. It would have been far cheaper and safer for the average American who pays the bills to stay out of foreign entanglements. For a very few, this racket, like bootlegging and other underworld rackets, brings fancy profits. But the cost of operations is always transferred to the people who do not profit. Take the World War. It cost the United States taxpayer some $52 billion, and we haven't paid that debt yet. But ultimately, it's the soldier who pays the biggest part of the bill. If you don't believe this, visit the American cemeteries on the battlefields abroad, or visit any of the veterans' hospitals in the United States. Napoleon once said, "All men are enamored of decorations. They positively hunger for them." So, by developing the Napoleonic system, the medal business, the government learned it could get soldiers for less money, because the boys liked to be decorated. Until the Civil War, there were no medals. Then the Congressional Medal of Honor was handed out. It made enlistments easier. In the World War, we used propaganda to make the boys accept conscription. They were made to feel ashamed if they didn't join the army. So vicious was this war propaganda that even God was brought into it. With few exceptions, our clergymen joined in the clamor to kill, kill, kill. To kill the Germans, God is on our side. It is His will that the Germans be killed. And in Germany, the good pastors called upon the Germans to kill the Allies, to please the same God. Beautiful ideals were painted for our boys who were sent out to die. This was the war to end all wars. This was the war to make the world safe for democracy. No one mentioned to them as they marched away that their going and their dying would mean huge war profits. Thus, having stuffed patriotism down their throats, it was decided to help make them pay for the war too. So we gave them the large salary of $30 a month. All they had to do for this munificent sum was to leave their dear ones behind, give up their jobs, lie in swampy trenches, and kill, and kill, and kill. And be killed. Well, war is a racket, all right. And the only way to smash this racket is to conscript capital, industry, and labor before the nation's manhood can be conscripted. Let all the officers, directors, high-powered executives, all the workers, managers, bankers, and yes, all the generals, admirals, officers, and all politicians, all government office holders, everyone in the nation, be restricted to a total monthly income not to exceed that paid to the soldier. Why shouldn't they? They aren't running any risk of being killed or having their bodies mangled or their minds shattered. The soldiers are! Give capital, industry, and labor 30 days to think it over, and I think you will find by that time there will be no war. Another step necessary in the fight to smash the war racket is the limited plebiscite to determine whether a war should be declared. A plebiscite not of all the voters, but merely of those who would be called upon to do the fighting and dying. There wouldn't be very much sense in having the president of a munitions factory or the head of an international banking firm or the manager of a uniform manufacturing plant, all of whom see visions of tremendous profits in the event of war, voting on whether the nation should go to war or not. They never would be called upon to shoulder arms. Only those who would be called upon to risk their lives for their country should have the privilege of voting to determine whether the nation should go to war. That would smash the war racket. That and nothing else. The next war, according to experts, will be fought not with battleships, not by artillery, not with rifles, and not with machine guns. It will be fought with deadly chemicals and gases. But victory or defeat will be determined by the skill and ingenuity of our scientists. If we put them to work making poison gas and more fiendish mechanical and explosive instruments of destruction, they will have no time for the constructive job of building a greater prosperity for all peoples. By putting them to this useful job, we can all make more money out of peace than we can out of war. So, I say, to hell with war!
Still there, oh, praise us, the Star Spangled.
Ask Cindy question today comes from Jacob Bartlett. Cindy, I get your emails, and although I do not always agree with what your message is, I find value in educating myself in opinions that are not my own. I do have a question, though, which does not need a long answer. Do you see any good that comes from war? Thank you for your response and patriotism. Jacob. Jacob, you're going to get a very short answer from me. And the answer is no. I see no value in war. Okay, that's it for today's show. I hope you learned something. And your soapbox assignment, again, is to spread the word about our radical show and to go to CindySheehanSoapbox.com and order my new internet booklet, Myth America. I have my engineer, Scott Cuddy, and my volunteer webmaster, Rich Bowser, and we are all three dedicated to building an online community that will lead to true and profound systemic changes, but we need your help. I'd like to again thank my guests, Ann Wright and Sarah Rich, my engineer, Scott Cuddy, and my webmaster, Rich Bowser. This is Cindy Sheehan, Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you again soon.
First, they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. If you would like to keep your voice on the air, and you feel this show is important, please contribute now. Go to www.CindySheehansSoapbox.com. That's CindySheehansSoapbox.com. The phone is 562-912-5860. That number again is 562-912-5860. Please help us keep this show on the air. Your generous contribution is appreciated.